Welcome to Blazing Trails, a Salesforce podcast. I'm Marissa Kranis, Social and Content Marketing Lead for Salesforce Strategic Events. We're bringing you access to the trailblazing stories we experience and collect at our events around the world. You'll hear from inspirational speakers and the latest game-changing innovations. Learn how to blaze new trails, map your path to the future, and most importantly, be your best. One way to be your best? Subscribe and review Blazing Trails wherever you get your podcasts. We're getting closer and closer to Dreamforce, and we'll be announcing big updates you don't want to miss out. During Dreamforce 2016, we held the second annual Women and Equality Summit. This day was dedicated to topics focused on economic equality, diversity, inclusion, the role business leaders can play, and more. Salesforce is an active supporter for equality, and we were excited to continue the conversation with visionary speakers and real, honest conversations. Some of the brightest, most forward-thinking, and driven leaders joined us from government, business, media, sports, and beyond. This episode is part one of our coverage of the Women and Equality Summit. Be sure to tune in next week for part two. The word leadership is multifaceted. For women today, it takes on meanings both at work and at home. In our first look at the Women and Equality Summit, we're looking at leadership lessons from two world-changing women when it comes to the changing definitions of family and home life. Anne-Marie Slaughter is president of New America Think Tank and wrote one of the most popular articles in recent memory called Why Women Still Can't Have It All. She argues the struggle of women having it all goes beyond affordable childcare and maternity leave and goes back to larger issues at work and in society. Joining Slaughter is Sarah Kate Ellis, president and CEO of GLAAD, a media monitoring organization founded by LGBTQ people in the media. Ellis's background and passion in media helped to champion her in her current activism and work for the LGBTQ community. Ellis and her wife both became pregnant on the same day. In their book, Times Two, Two Women in Love and the Happy Family They Made, they chronicle the highs and lows of starting a beautifully non-traditional family. Slaughter and Ellis sat down with SVP of Desk.com, Layla Seca, for an insightful panel on leadership lessons, family lessons, and how women are redefining their roles both at work and at home. Let's get started with an introduction from Salesforce's General Counsel, Amy Weaver.
For me, perhaps like many of you, I've spent most of my career in situations where I was the only or one of the only women in the room. I began at a law firm where I was the only female lawyer at that location. And later at my last company before joining Salesforce, upon becoming executive vice president, I became the first and only female executive in the Fortune 500 company's nearly 100-year history. Now, I've always had wonderful and supportive colleagues, but I have to say I would be lying if I said that this has always been easy, especially as a young lawyer and really struggling and looking for role models to model my own behavior on. But one of the lessons I learned and had to learn very, very early on was to trust my own instincts of what it meant to be a leader. And sometimes that meant ignoring the well-meaning advice of my colleagues who were eager to mold me into their own definition of leadership based on what they had seen for generations before. For one example, I recall years ago being preparing for a really tough negotiation. And I was firmly instructed by a senior colleague that what I needed to do was to aggressively walk into the room, lay down the law, preferably using a few choice words that he suggested for me, and whatever happened, not to be too nice. In other words, a style that would have worked perfectly for him, but couldn't be further from my own style. So I heard him out. And then to his utter dismay, told him that that was no way how I intended to handle the situation. But then I asked him, when was the last time he had sent me into a negotiation or other meeting, and he hadn't gotten the result he wanted? Well, that stumped him. The fact was, I succeeded when I did things on my own terms and with my own style, not relying on his or what would work for any of my other colleagues. If I had marched into that room, smacked the table and cursed, The only thing I can guarantee you is that everyone in the room would have burst into laughter. I would have looked and felt ridiculous because it wouldn't have been authentic. But by relying on my own skills, I knew I could navigate the situation, and I did successfully. And I think when we look at leadership, we need to start looking at new models of what it means to be a leader. It's important not only for all of us to do that and hold ourselves to those standards, but everyone in the room needs to be doing that for their employees and their colleagues. So a very small example, but when I first joined Salesforce 3 years ago, we instituted an award for members of the legal and corporate security team. It's a quarterly award, and it was called, we still have it, it's called the Little Red Fire Engine Award. And this goes to the legal team member who, during the quarter, came to the rescue. Get it? Usually on the big transaction with the flashy heroics. And their reward is they get to keep a 3-foot red fire engine, complete with lights and a horn, on their desk for 3 months. But after we started this award, it became concerned, along with members of my leadership team, that we were only recognizing one type of model behavior. So we instituted a second award, the Elmer's Glue Award. This award is for the employee who comes in every day, working hard, doing their job consistently well, head down, no theatrics, quietly supporting the rest of the team, and basically making the department a better place for all of us to be. This person gets a 2-gallon jug of Elmer's Glue for binding us together as a workplace. Now, this may sound trivial, it's a small way to recognize two equally important forms of leadership that both need to be recognized. So today, as you're going forward, I would ask you to challenge yourself. When you think of who a leader is and those qualities, we need to be thinking in new and different ways. And now with that, it is my pleasure to introduce one of my favorite leaders at Salesforce, who definitely brings her own unique style to everything she does. And that is our fantastic Senior Vice President and General Manager of Desk.com, Leila Seika. Thank you.
Hello, everybody. How you doing? Welcome, welcome, welcome. My name's Leila Seika, as Amy said. I've been at Salesforce for 9 years. I've done a variety of different things here. None of them are even remotely as interesting as what these two women have done. So we're gonna talk to them. First, Anne-Marie Slaughter. I'll give you a light bio on each of them and then we'll talk. Anne-Marie was the dean at Princeton. She ran the Woodrow Wilson School at Harvard. She was in the State Department under Secretary Clinton. She now runs New America. She wrote the most downloaded article ever in the history of the Atlantic that was Women Can't Have It All. I think every single person I know sent me that article. I really do. My mother-in-law, my mom. So she is someone to reckon with and an absolute force. Next, Sarah Kate Ellis. Sarah Kate is amazing. She started out in media. She worked at Real Simple. She worked at Time Inc. She's now the president and CEO of GLAAD. She too has written a pretty amazing book about her experience, which we'll talk about. So that's a little bit of like the overall general thing. Now let's get to it. All right, ladies. I've been waiting for this one. Okay, so we know you guys are very accomplished. Anne-Marie, tell me a little bit. Let's start with you. How did this happen? How did you go into the State Department? Why did you write that article? What? Tell me.
All right, so I have to start with the Atlantic originally didn't think they wanted the article because it's not like I was the first woman to write about how it's hard to have kids and a job at the same time. Right. And indeed, the week before the article came out, we couldn't get, even though it was on the cover of The Atlantic, we couldn't get any of the TV shows to book me because it was the same idea. So then it goes on Wednesday night, it goes up. By Friday, 400,000 people have downloaded it. And I'm on the front page of the New York Times, and my mother calls up and says, "What have you done?" And I have to say, nothing prepared me for that. No one, I think I caught a generational wave. When you say people sent it to you, a lot of mothers sent it to daughters. A lot of times people were on different sides of an argument, so people would say to me, yes, my daughter sent it to me. Or men would say to me, my wife brought it home. And then there'd be this silence, which meant, and we had a huge fight. So I didn't expect it, but I've now spent 4 years obviously talking about that and then writing a book, Unfinished Business, and really thinking through not just, okay, this is hard, we know that, but how are we gonna get to real, full female-male equality.
Yes.
Gender equality.
Absolutely, and we are gonna talk about that. Okay, Sarah-Kate, you also wrote a book. Yours is a little different. Tell us a little bit about it. And you made a big shift. You were like a magazine editor, media mogul.
Right.
And now you run GLAAD. That's a shift. Tell us a little bit about how that came to be.
Yes, I was in almost for two decades at Time Inc. and Condé Nast and ran everything from Vogue to Real Simple. And so, media has always been my passion, but I was always an activist too. And I would use media for my activism. I knew how powerful media was. And I worked with GLAAD when my book came out. So my wife and I got pregnant on the exact same day. It was by accident, it can be.
Happy accident.
Well, I had been trying for a very long time and it wasn't working. And so then the first time she tried happened to fall on the same day that I was trying. I was like, we have two ovens. We just want one bun. Let's go. And then boom. And our doctors were like, you are more likely to get struck by lightning than for this to happen. So they're 7 years old now, the twins, but when this happened, I was working at Real Simple, and the editor-in-chief there is this woman, Kristen Van Ogtrop. And what's interesting is that Real Simple, I knew all this because I worked there, goes to about 8 million readers across America, and most of them are in the middle of the country. And Kristen said to me, she said, I want to track you and cover your story, your dual pregnancy. And I was thinking, oh, wow, that means I'm really coming out, and this is super personal.
Sure.
But I thought the audience that it would hit and show this new kind of family and how we're evolving as a culture would be really powerful and impactful. So I agreed to do it. And from there, the woman who was interviewing us said, this is a book. And so, and my wife's a writer, so we ended up doing a book about it. So I went to GLAAD, but the day before the book was about to come out, and I panicked and thinking to myself, what did I just do?
Yes.
I wasn't thinking. I have these two newborns. It was they were 1 year old, and this book was coming out to say everything, all my family secrets. And so I went to GLAAD, and they taught me how to handle press. They taught me how to deal with the book tour and how to talk to the people in the middle who needed their hearts and minds to be changed about LGBTQ issues. And I found it very, very empowering. And then from there, I also landed on the cover of Time magazine, my wife and I, and I got a call from my mother about that one. We were kissing on that one.
Yeah!
It was when DOMA got brought down at Supreme Court, and they had called and said, would you do this? And I thought, oh, well, it's already all out there. What else do I have to lose? Right. I didn't think of my mother. But anyway, so I know that call. I've gotten it. I just want to say one thing that GLAAD, for those who don't know, is about changing culture. It's about accelerating acceptance for the LGBT community. And the way that we do that is through the media. So we do it through news and journalism, we do it through social media and digital platforms, and we also do it through Hollywood entertainment and streaming content.
And you've brought a lot of that to GLAAD with your media expertise. I mean, I've read a lot about you, so
I'm
a slight stalker, both of you.
You have to know media in order to run a media advocacy organization, and so it just combined both my passions.
Which is awesome.
Yeah.
Okay, so you both have talked about, and I think this is really sort of the crux of it, the dynamic of the June and Ward Cleaver family, boom, we're done with that, right? That's not how, great if that's yours and that's your choice, go for it. But all of us, my husband doesn't work, he goes to school, he's the primary parent. We all have our different lives.
Right.
So with that new definition of family, like how do we as a society kind of, you are two of the like front thinkers on this, how do we kind of take this in and how do people that aren't so comfortable with that change, because it takes people time, how do they sort of embrace it or what advice would you give them?
You know, I think you can do it with just the numbers and getting people to look around them and realize how few families you know who look like Ward and June Cleaver. And really the first set of changes, of course, was blended families.
Right. It,
over my lifetime, the waves of divorce, remarriage, all of that. So those families, everybody has that. It's in their family in some way. And then starting to think, well, wait a minute, as women become primary breadwinners or breadwinners generally, and figuring out who ought to be at home, who ought to be working. And then to me, the same-sex marriage has been hugely important. Yes. Because when I tell people, look, men can be fathers and primary parents, lead parents, as I call them, just as much as women can. And many women don't buy that. We have a lot of sexism to get through in terms of our own assumptions about what we are confident we can do what men can do. We are a whole lot less confident that men can do what we can do. You know that's true.
That's a great point.
But so I point out, I say, look, if you are two men or two women, there's not a default role, right? There's not this, I'm the woman, so obviously I'm the caregiver. You're the man, so obviously you're the breadwinner, and we can both do both, but when we have to make a choice, that's it. If you're two men or two women, you say, who's more ambitious? Right. Who's got a better boss? Who's making more money? Who's got the more flexible schedule? Who wants to do this? I mean, I really, my husband is a lot, he's more patient than I am, and he will spend hours on music lessons. I won't, right? So I think really the GLBTQ revolution opens up ways of reconceiving families for heterosexual families, traditional families, in lots of different configurations.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. I completely agree. And I also think that when we look at the next generation, and I'm mired right now with Gen Z because I'm really trying to understand the generation and see where we're headed, especially as an LGBTQ movement. And when you look at them, they don't even know what that means when you say the Cleavers. They have no idea, right? Like, it has remnants with us who are a little bit older, but they don't understand that there was a traditional family and this is the way, because they're not growing up that way, right? So this generational change is happening as we speak, you know? So they're experiencing life so differently, like your kids, or
totally.
If anybody has kids and you have a different setup than what's traditional. And so I think the new traditional is the non-traditional. And when we look there, we can absolutely see that. But I also agree that these same-sex marriage, I hope, not only brought great equality for the LGBTQ community, but it also brought it for men and women, and that it sort of broke down all of these cultural constraints that we have to live under and bear versus creating a path that works for us.
Absolutely.
Right. You know?
And I would say the other thing here is there's a race and ethnic and cultural component here. So, you know, in the Moynihan Report back in the 60s was essentially, here's what a family looks like, a man and a woman and two kids and a dog. And African-American families don't look like that, so they're broken, right? And we need to fix them. Well, actually, Mia Birdsong, who's a New America California fellow here, is looking at, wait a minute, what we actually need are strong and flexible families. We need families who can support each other. Most cultures other than white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, they work much more with extended families, right? Your aunts, your uncles, your grandparents. Most cultures around the world and in this country are not traditionally, well, you marry and you move out. So this is also about embracing different models of a family without assuming here's one and everything that deviates from that is deviant.
Totally. So I mean, I completely agree with you. This is how I'm living my life. My husband's right there. I'm with you, right? But it's hard. Like you both mentioned, your moms called you, right? I'm sure they called you and said, I'm very proud of you, and then said something because they're moms, right? We all have those. You know, it's hard. Like sometimes it's hard for me. Sometimes people are like, oh, you don't love your kids as much because you like your job. Or they look at my husband and they say, oh, you're not ambitious, you don't want to work. Give me a sense, what do you say to people when they come to you and say, oh, you know, what if I came to you and said, oh, they're telling me I don't love my kids. I love my kids. I'm working for my kids. I'm working so they have the example. But how do you do that? How do you deal with that?
So I just say, I know I'm a much better mother because I work. I would be terrible if I were home all the time. And my kids absolutely agree. The one experiment We took 1 year sabbatical where I was, you know, could pour all that energy into them. They're like, nah. So, but the other thing I point out is my husband supports me.
Yeah.
Right? That's the traditional role, right? Your partner supports you. I can't do what I do without his support. And it is true, you know, in-laws, parents, that sort of wider society, well, wait a minute, you know, why are you earning more money? As if that's the measure. And my response is, I support him, he supports me. Neither of us can do what we do without the other. And, you know, why shouldn't fathers have the same ability to be totally connected to their kids as mothers have traditionally had?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Definitely.
I agree.
I totally
agree. Of course, Sarah Kay, you have a great perspective on this, too. I mean, give us...
Well, I mean, it's interesting having a wife and not having a husband.
Exactly.
So you do define your gender roles, right? And so we've found what works exactly for us. I do travel a tremendous amount for work. My wife is in a rock band, so she'll travel, but it'll be in these real big fits and spurts, you know? We've always sort of created our own... normal or whatever you want to call it. But to your point, I think what's really important is that we stop judging each other and trying to make ourselves feel better for that. Like, I'd never raised my kids in New York City, but a lot of my friends do. And there's this big divide between stay-at-home moms and working moms. Yeah, yeah. And it always blows my mind. We're all working.
Right.
Like, stay-at-home dads work. Stay-at-home moms work.
Hard.
Hard.
Yeah. And they don't get bonuses.
No.
And no one says, good job.
They can't get on a plane and watch a movie.
No.
I might put that in every now and then, you know? I just think that we have to ask each other to support each other. And you can actually say that and take somebody's defenses down with that and say, actually, I value what you do.
Right.
I hope you value what I do.
Right.
And I think we can learn from each other, too, from that.
Absolutely. Okay, so you're also both CEOs. I mean, we're going to keep talking about all this for sure, but you're also both CEOs. I mean, you are these powerhouses that are out there really advocating for this, and I'm deeply grateful to both of you. You've made my life better. I know that, but... So you're also CEOs, so you have to lead companies, right? You lead a political think tank, you lead a nonprofit. So clearly you have big missions, but how do you lead, given all this too, all this celebrity you both have around the fact that you've stood up and said these amazing things and sort of shifted society's paradigm of how they view. And when you go to work, how do you lead? It's a very general question, but I'm going to do it to you.
So the first thing I think about leadership is you have to find your own style. So I became a dean. I was 42. The only thing I'd run until then was an international law program. And suddenly I'm the head of 70 faculty members, most of whom are tenured, over whom I really have no power, and 300 students and 100 staff. And so I looked around, and the models I saw were mostly male, and they were kind of what I call Olympian, you know, that sort of distance and gravitas, and you know, you sort of project this quiet, serious. And I thought, that quiet, serious is not me. The best advice I got was figure out sort of who you are and then make a leader out of that. So for me, that means making connections with people. That means not being very hierarchical. I don't like saying people work for me. I typically say people work with me. Even my assistant, we work together. Now that doesn't mean I'm not the boss, and it doesn't mean I don't make hard decisions. But my style is more collaborative, more hierarchical. I'm very big on owning it. And it's interesting, my inclination periodically is to apologize. You know, if we've done something wrong, my inclination is to say we screwed up, you know? Many of the men who work for me are not comfortable with that. They don't like, you know, it's too confessional. Don't explain, don't complain, don't explain, just keep going. And I just think, look, you got to be authentic to who you are. And if you are, you're still gonna lead. You are responsible and you will make tough decisions and people won't like you. That is...
Leadership.
Leadership, right? If everybody likes you, you are not doing very much. I mean, you could do it better or worse, but people have to know that person is not putting on a mask or a role. That person is who that person is and is leading.
Right.
Yeah, I agree. I think being real and authentic is very important. And when I was first coming up in my career, I was at InStyle, and I knew I was gay, but I was not out. And I thought to myself, this is my own crazy head thinking, if you're a gay man, you can be outed in style, but if you're a lesbian, you're gonna freak out all the women there because they're very fashion-y and, you know, and so playing all these stereotypes real time. And my career was really important to me and I didn't wanna put it on the line. But then I took a job at Real Simple magazine and I thought, I have to be real or I can't, I'm never going to get where I need to go. And so it was not during the job interview, but the first second I was able to, I said, well, my girlfriend and I was like, oh my God, I just said that, you know, all the panic is coming, which isn't the case now for kids as much in the workplace in some parts of the country.
Right.
I want to be clear about that. But once that happened, it unleashed to, and then I could become a leader. Because then I was real, I was honest. I think you have to be an honest person. And one other thing that I do is that I sort of collect people, really smart people that I trust and that I can talk to in the wee hours of the morning because there are really hard decisions. Yeah. And especially as an activist, you're gonna go toe-to-toe with some really big places sometimes and big people, and it's very intimidating. And you need to be able to talk to somebody and you really can't talk to your team all that much about
that
it.
That is really true.
And so I've collected sort of my cabinet who don't work with me but are in, some are in Hollywood, some are in New York, in news and journalism, and I can talk to them or ping them at any point, and they've got my back. And I think that's really, really important. And for you to do that to someone else.
I think you made a really important point about not sharing too much with your team. I think for many women where we, you know, we connect, we forge a relationship, your instinct initially is, you know, the people who work with you, they're your friends. Okay. And they are until you have to give them a bad review.
Yes.
Right? Or you have to, you know, make changes that they're not happy with. And that, so understanding that you can have a great relationship with your team, but they're not your friends like your friends you call up in the middle of the night. I think that's important.
I think that's really interesting. So how do you hold that line? How do you be friends and work with, not, you're not mine, you know, we work together, but not cross that friendship line? Like, how do you hold yourself as an executive not to do that? I'm not sure I do it very
I struggle
well.
With it.
I don't think I do it very well, so it's a genuine question.
I bet none of us do it very well.
It's hard.
I mean, I think I have learned to keep a little more distance. I mean, if you have a great team, it's not that you're not close, but you do, you have to kind of keep that distance that says, you know, in the end, I got to take this home. I've got to make this decision.
Right.
And actually, I guess the way I do it most is periodically making myself disagree. You know, in other words, the tendency becomes you don't want to say anything because you're going to hurt their feelings, and you just can't give in to that. So I would say I probably am close, but I insist on the kind of, I hear you, I don't agree, I'm going to decide this way.
Right. Interesting, interesting. What about you?
Any? Yeah, no, I think it's really, that's really important because I do have boundary issues like that.
We all do.
And I think we're just, there's a nature about connecting. I think I do that too. Now that you say it, you articulate these so well, but I do disagree with them. And then I do reserve, I don't do social things as much.
Yeah.
And our lives are very social in my work. There are galas and there's events. I mean, you could go to an event every night. And so the team will go out after. I do not. I go home. And I think that's appropriate. And that's how I keep a little bit of distance.
No, I think that makes a lot of sense. I think that makes a lot of sense. Okay, so now I'm going to switch it up a little bit. Who was your best boss? Like, if you think about the person, like, that you worked for at one point and that you're like, this is my best boss. It's not an easy question. I didn't tell them I was going to ask this beforehand, so it's not very nice. Okay, all right, so Sarah Kate's going. Okay, come on.
My most amazing boss is actually my number one advisor now.
Oh.
And so he and I have worked together for 15 years. And his name is Grant Schneider, and he hired me at Real Simple and trained me. Literally taught me how to be the best marketer, how to be the best executive that he knew. And I don't make a move without him, and he doesn't make one without me. I mean, maybe that's not good, but
it's
worked.
Work together
your work
no, he does work with
oh,
me
Oh, he does
now.
Work with you. So.
Yeah,
oh,
ever
oh,
since
cool.
when I was considering taking the position at GLAAD, this is an interesting thing, which is very sort of women-centric, is that when I took the position at GLAAD, it was a turnaround, and it was a do or die. So I was going to be the president that saved it, or that shut it down. And I really didn't want to be the person that had to shut it down.
Yeah.
Not a 30-year-old magnificent brand and mover and cultural changer. And so I was a little apprehensive. It was grim. I started with a depletion model. Every month I would see the deplete, every week actually, on how many days we had until we had to close the front doors. We've grown in that 3 years, 55%, and we're doing phenomenally well. So I'm very proud of that and excited for that.
Good job.
Thank you. But I brought Grant with me, is my point. Even when I was taking the job, I was thinking, I said to him, you know, what is this going to do to my reputation? Like, I can have real conversations, and he works with me, but he's not on staff. Which is amazing, too, because that's another big secret. Like, if you get in a leadership position, to have someone who's not embedded in the team sees the interaction and can give you the real story, because one of the challenges of leading is that you don't know that you're always getting the real story, because people want to, and it's just like I do to my board. You know, I'm no different. I want to show them all the roses, not the thorns.
Sure.
He and I have been together now 15 years.
That's awesome. Okay, what about
So this is actually easy. It's Hillary Clinton. Because she was a great boss, but also for the simple reason I didn't have a boss till I was 50.
Right.
I was a professor and a dean and a president of the university. They're not really your boss. You're an independent contractor as a professor. I mean, if you really do something terrible, yes, they can fire you, but more or less, you work on your own. And so part of the whole, my experience at the State Department, leaving the State Department, writing this article was, I had a great boss, but she was a boss and I was accountable to her.
Right.
And that meant for the first time at 50, I really experienced that tug of war that so many of us experience all the time. If you're in the corporate setting where, you know, my child was in Princeton, I would get these phone calls saying, you know, he's done X or Y, and I would be there. It was always on the day of an important meeting, always, without exception. And, you know, there I would be, and Secretary Clinton was really understanding. If I said, you know, I've got to get on a train and go home, that was fine. But I also knew she had expectations of me, and of course she had to. But she was a great boss.
So there's another question I wanted to kind of get to, and we're running a little low in time, but just one more. What is the role of government and business subsequently in helping us redefine this new definition of equality across men and women and LGBTQ and everybody, right? Everyone, like, let's give everyone a level playing field and, you know, we'll judge people on skill and state of character. So what do you think the government and business subsequently, what should we be doing? What's the deal?
Well, I actually think Mark is doing a phenomenal job at it. And I've recognized that for quite a while and been a real supporter of raising him up in terms of pointing to how you do it, how you are a good ally, how you can use your platform. And I think the thing that I love about Mark is because he's taught me that as CEOs in Fortune 500 companies, Fortune 100 companies, there's an obligation to creating a culture and a world that is better. And using the platform that you are given, because you're traveling all over the world as a CEO, you're meeting with heads of states, you're meeting with dignitaries all over the world, and you have an opportunity to say something, to help move the needle forward. And leveraging that opportunity is really, really important for the good of the world, really, and to make a better world. And so I think that there is a big onus on corporations as they reap the profits of the people they need to give back to the people in some way, shape, or form. You want to take government? You're good on
it. Absolutely. Salesforce, you know, there are great companies out there that are doing the right thing. Just before I came today, Levi Strauss, I got an email from Levi Strauss saying 8 weeks of parental leave, men or women. That's great, right? That is wonderful. But I do think this is a case where we have to make a decision as a society, the same decision that every other advanced industrial economy has made, which is we value investing in the next generation. We value caring for those who cared for us. I think it's worth it. I think it's worth it in terms of retention and recruitment and all sorts of things. But in the end, just like 100 years ago, we didn't have wage and hour legislation, right? It was fine. A company could ask you to work 20 hours, and the government didn't say anything. And the first states that had 10-hour workdays, not eight, 10-hour workdays, those were challenged and struck down by the Supreme Court. But lo and behold, we decided, you know, we're actually going to be a better country if we don't let employers work people to death,
right,
literally.
Right.
So we have now wage and hour restrictions. And similarly, I do think government has to mandate paid family leave. And I think we need high quality, affordable childcare. And again, this is probably less for many of the women in this room,
right,
but it is absolutely, we have too few women at the top, but way too many at the bottom. So the poorest members of our society are working and trying to care for others and with no support, yep, and no childcare. They can lose their job if they have to stay home with their kids. So we need to do that just for what kind of society we are, but also frankly for our health and for our equality.
I agree 100% on that. Yes.
What does it take to drive change and offer advice on breaking into the world of corporate boards? Having women in the boardroom is more important now than ever. In this panel, we will hear from a powerhouse group of women who have earned a boardroom seat. They have the amazing opportunity to impact change from the top. Sukhinder Singh Cassidy serves on the boards of Ericsson and TripAdvisor. She is the founder of The Board List, a LinkedIn-like tool that matches peer-endorsed women with companies seeking board diversity. Clara Shi, CEO and founder of Hearsay Social, serves on the board of Starbucks. Claire Hughes Johnson, COO of Stripe, sits on the board of Hallmark Cards and as a trustee of Milton Academy. In this panel, moderated by Forbes staff writer Alex Conrad, we hear from these three inspiring women on life in the boardroom. Let's listen in.
I'm never going to be on a board as a journalist. I'm also never going to be helping the diversity of a board, but I find this a really important topic that we don't talk about enough. And I think next year we need to have, you know, twice as many people here to talk about this because I think it's just so critical. I thought we would start with just getting the story of these three very important and interesting executives, how they got to the place they are today, and then how they got to these boards. So if we don't have to go up and down the whole time, but for this time, I'm going to say we're going to start with Sukhinder, if that's okay.
Sure, sure. Because this is mostly about boards, I won't spend that much time on my executive history, but I spent the majority of my career in my own startup, Yodlee, and now Joyous, which is another startup I run. And in between that, a very big chunk of time as a senior executive at Google, running Asia Pacific and Latin America. Other pieces to my story, but those are the biggest ones. And I joined my first board when I was at Google, and I really wanted to, interestingly, before I ever made a career shift into women's commerce and media, which is what Joyce is about, I actually wanted to understand women's commerce much better. So I sort of declared I wanted my first board, and I really wanted it to be in retail, and ended up talking to people in my network about that, and was introduced to Mickey Drexler, and that's how I joined the J.Crew board. And my subsequent boards, I think, and we'll talk about this today, when you think about what gets you on a board and what keeps you there, one of the big themes right now, as you probably all know, particularly on public boards, is the digitization of public boards. Everybody is looking for, you know, a set of competencies around being a digital director. That was the same at J.Crew. Other core competencies, international. Obviously, I ran international at Google, a big chunk of our operations. And those two things tend to be in large demand or functional expertise. And so when I think about how I've made my way to those boards, the intersection of my career path with those is basically spot on.
Thank you so much for having me here. My story is I started off as a software engineer at Microsoft, and then I worked at Google as well in business operations, and then I came to Salesforce and I worked in product marketing and product management. And I started Hearsay 7 years ago, and a couple of years into founding Hearsay, I was approached by a search firm regarding the Starbucks board. I think a lot of you in this room may know or at least know of Sheryl Sandberg. She had referred me as one of the potential successors when she was stepping off that board, and it worked out, and it's been a fantastic 5 years. I agree with Sukhinder's statement around the digitization of boards, and we find that even in the searches that Starbucks has done in the last couple of years, we're either looking for those with Fortune 500, sitting CEO, or recently retired experience, or we're looking for specialists. And it could be a China specialist, it could be emerging markets, it could be any number of things, but technology and digital is increasingly a big part of the specialization that boards are looking for.
Great, yeah, thanks for being here with this panel and to Salesforce for hosting us. I'm finding it funny that we could potentially be drowned out by a very loud guy in the next room, but we will prevail.
How typical.
How typical. But I would say, so my career-wise, I worked, actually, I sort of had an unusual beginning to my career, which is very apropos for the moment we're in the US, which is I worked in politics and government for a number of years, and then I flipped over and worked in consulting and then ended up having this insight that technology was all of my clients were struggling with the onset of the internet, frankly. And so I moved to the West Coast and I ended up at Google for over 10 years. And
by the way, you don't have to work at Google to get a board.
You don't have to, but it
happens to be.
Claire and I were joking backstage. It was helpful at the time, I think. But actually, frankly, having people like Sukhinder at Google, who was on a board, started me thinking about my development, and certainly people started to talk to me about why that was worthwhile. And I'll be really honest and say, at the time, I had become an executive at Google, but I also was the mom of a couple of young kids, and I was thinking, can I really do this? So my passage into it was to be very thoughtful about what I could commit to at the time. And so I started by joining a nonprofit board, the board of a school. It's actually good learning because as someone who's more of an operator, your job on a board is not to be the operator. And I really had to restrain myself in board meetings from trying to run the school. And so I think that was great practice to then go and do Hallmark, which is a private board, which is less time commitment. I'm just gonna be honest in that. Two things that drove that decision for me were, one, I was at Google at the time, and Google competes with a lot of companies. So many boards that did actually start recruiting me, I couldn't join because they were competitive with Google. But the other was I was concerned about my time, and Hallmark runs itself like a public company. It owns Crayola, it owns Crown Media. It's actually three separate companies, which is really interesting. But the board is small, and we serve on every committee. And the pitch to me by the recruiter was like, you're gonna learn every piece of being on a board, and you're not gonna be expected to do a lot of work outside of the board meeting. And that's been true, and it's been valuable. And so I think it was the right decision. And now I think about, okay, what's my next? You know, you can start to think about what's your next board and what are issues you care about? We can probably talk later, but Hallmark had some meaning to me, which I'm happy to discuss, but I'm sure the next one might be a little bit more on this coast. We'll see.
So, it sounds like a recruiter was an important person in this process. Before you guys started talking to a recruiter, those two at least, not Sukhinder.
Mostly.
Well, for all of you, as you're rising in your career, was there a point of seniority or a point of sort of confidence in your career track that you were thinking that this was something you would want to do to join an outside board?
For me, absolutely not. To be honest, I wasn't exactly sure what public company directors did when I was approached. I mean, credit to Cheryl for seeing in me something that I didn't see in myself. And I obviously know what's required now, but not something that I had necessarily aspired to.
I would say I was pretty deliberate, but to be clear, before I joined an outside board, or an outside public board, like Claire, I joined a nonprofit board 7 years earlier. And interestingly, and I would say this to people because I think it's actually, when I look back in my history, when I was at Yodlee and I was 28 years old when I started that company, Excel was an investor. And to their credit, when I was maybe 30 years old, the partner at Excel was like, you should be on a board. And he actually went to Comscore and introduced me to the two founders and tried to get Comscore to take me as a board member. And they said I was too junior. And it was fine. I know Jan and I love the Comscore team. But my point was simply, I was like, wow, they were really, like, early on, they went to bat for me. I would never have thought about it when I was 29 years old. But I think they saw something in me, and I didn't get the board. But I subsequently joined a nonprofit board. Again, the same partner at Excel, Bud Colligan, who was the CEO of Macromedia, was on a nonprofit board in the Valley, and he invited me to join, and I joined, and I was on that board for 7 years, six of them before I took my first public board. So I did think about it. And like Claire, I highly advise thinking about private boards and nonprofit boards if you want to see what board service is really like.
Whereas, Clara, you just took the plunge and jumped into a pretty big corporate board.
Yeah, well, I'd only had experience at that point 2 years running my own board at Hearsay. And, I mean, it's more differences than similarities, although there are some interesting similarities, too.
So can you guys give us whatever comes to mind when you think of what you expected you were signing up for versus what being on a board is really like, especially, you know, for people here who might be thinking about it but haven't been inside a boardroom yet? What was it like to sort of get into full swing in that process?
Yeah, I mean, I think you have this sense that a board has a governance responsibility, but it's not entirely clear to you, like, what is that, getting into the minutia of the audit results, or is that you're constantly making sure the CEO, right, because that's your responsibility, is doing a great job. You have this vague sense of it, and then you show up, I mean, for me at Hallmark, 4 times a year, and it's actually very helpful when I think about Stripe and our board at Stripe, which is, it's a very different perspective on the company, and you are bringing something fresh. The people running a company are naturally very close to it, and your job is to come in and, yes, do the governance piece, but also be their ally in saying, hey, I might be seeing something that you're not seeing because you're so close to it. So the richest part of the board meeting, which I didn't really expect, is the dinner we have the night before, where we talk about, like, the executives are a little bit more casual. They're not presenting. I mean, I don't know, some boards do this, some don't, but they're not presenting. They're talking about what's going on. And we're sort of saying, okay, help us understand that, or why did you make that choice? And then also at the end of the board meeting, we kind of give feedback when, because many of, at the board meeting, many units of the company are presenting to you, and you're understanding the deep dive on, you know, what's this year's plan and what is the strategic project that we're doing. They all leave, and you're sitting with the leadership team, and they want to know, what did you think? Like, are these people doing a good job for us? You know, are they on the right track? And so I've found the advisory outside perspective, but I know your business well enough, is much more valuable. But what gets presented to us can really vary in the appropriateness of the level of what we see. And that helps me with my current role in a way that I didn't really anticipate. I don't know if that's useful. I don't know what you thought you would be doing. What committee are you on?
I'm on the comp committee and the nominating and governance committee. So, yeah, I think, I mean, to your point, the board director's role is around governance. And that's, you know, nowhere is that more true than in large public companies. I'd say, looking at my own board members at Hearsay, especially early on, they were much more hands-on, just because we hadn't built out a complete executive team, and they often stepped up and helped us with some of the operating challenges that we had. That would just never happen at a Fortune 500 company. And so I think a big learning for me, similar to Claire, was just understanding what is the role of the board member and what is the role of each committee, and, you know, spending that first, those first few meetings, that first year, listening and learning and building those relationships with each person on the management team, as well as the other board directors, and then really being able to provide value, insight, ask questions of the team.
Yeah, I mean, I think they've covered most of it. The only things I would add is, I think distinguishing the role of a board member in a nonprofit, a private, and a public is very different. In a nonprofit, you can certainly expect that a lot of it is hands-on. A lot of it is about fundraising. So I think if you're going to join a nonprofit board, you should expect that you're either both giving and you are expected to help get other people to give. I think that's one of the most important things to realize about a nonprofit board. Yes, they want all your operational advice, but really the thing that they struggle with the most is fundraising. So that's something to know about a nonprofit. On the private board versus the public board, just to juxtapose those experiences, and I've sat on private boards as well. I sat on the board at Stitch Fix, and I was the first board member there along with an investor. And I was a board member at Jay Hilburn, which is a men's retailer. And I would just characterize, if you're somebody really like enjoys operational work, I think a private company board actually is where the CEO is dying, in fact, for as much time as you're going to give them, right? So I think you almost have the opposite pull, which is you'll get pulled in as much as you want to help the executives, because the whole reason you're there is the VCs don't add that much operating value. They add a lot of capital value and, quite frankly, strategic value, because they see a whole world that you don't see, because they're looking at 10 companies in a space and you're in year one. So they actually add a pretty interesting strategic perspective. But I think from an operator's perspective, a CEO of a private company wants to take as much as you're going to give. In a public company, the CEO really doesn't want you stepping in and trying to run his executive team. You are there to be a partner, and he is still the team captain, I mean, particularly if he's chair of the board. So you are there for the other board members, and to represent shareholders. But the CEO is coaching that board on what he needs to extract, the value he needs to extract from you, and the role he needs you to play. But he certainly doesn't want you overstepping your bounds.
That's an important distinction. What I did find that was common, though, between Starbucks board meetings and Hearsay board meetings is the importance of the relationship and the team dynamics. And this is really where diversity plays such an important role. Yeah. Diversity, every way that you define it, people coming from very different places, very different backgrounds, and that resulting in incredibly valuable and rich discussions around the strategic direction of the company. This is why it's so important that we have this discussion. This is why it's so important that we need more women on boards.
So you guys have seen a mix of boards being constructed with you guys sort of on the inside and then also being added to boards that are growing. How is a balanced board, sort of a diverse board, created today? And how does someone sort of find balance so that you're getting different perspectives? Just from your experiences, what has worked well?
Well, first of all, the only way you create a balanced board is by creating a pretty robust pipeline. It's obvious, but it needs to be stated. I would also just tell you that I think public companies are ahead of private companies, particularly in the Valley, on this. Because public companies, they are planning their board for years to come. They know when terms are expiring. They're very methodical. They know exactly the skill sets they're trying to add. They know what, like they'll say, we need one digital expert. We need one person on international. We need somebody from supply chain. By the way, if it could be a woman, great. Some of them will say, we are actually going to fill the slate. We need to see a 50-50 slate. So I think that public boards, I think it's very planned out. It's like succession planning of your executive team.
Yeah.
And I think if they do the right job of recruiting a diverse pipeline, which is what a lot of headhunting firms right now are charted with, like, bring me a diverse pipeline. If you bring a diverse pipeline, it's not about quotas. Then it's about having right full representation at the table and constructing your board. And I think private companies, unfortunately, it's really not like that. I think on private companies, it is an afterthought. The founder doesn't really worry about it too much until the point where they embark on a disagreement with their venture capital firm, on which point they would really love an operator in the room. And so in some ways, I find it shocking, and of course, it's why we created the board list. We don't do as much work marketing women as we do marketing the value of a board, because at exactly the point where you need the help and quite frankly, go out and recruit people who you can never afford to pay on your executive team, and you can tap into their brain power. Founders are afraid of adding independence to their board because they think they lose control. But the reality is they've already lost control to their VCs, and the way to have a balanced perspective in the boardroom is to bring in the independent. So I'm just making a big push here.
No, it is amazing what you've helped address the issue. I mean, should we talk about the board list?
Yeah, I think
Well, it doesn't have to be about the board list, but it is about private company.
No, but I think a lot of people have talked about this problem, and you've actually done something about it.
Yeah, if anyone doesn't know the board list, maybe you would be so kind as to give us just a quick overview of what you're doing, and then we can talk about how that helps.
Yeah, exactly. Like the wider question, of course, I'll talk about what specifically the board list does. So the board list is a curated marketplace built here in Silicon Valley by the amazing team in the front row here that basically allows us to invite an endorsed community of leaders, tech leaders, VCs, to sponsor or endorse women that they would recommend for boards from early stage to public. And we've been nominating community about 700 leaders here in Silicon Valley and about 40 VC firms. And Clara are both part of the board list. And on the other side of it, we've nominated, through the nomination so far, about 2,000 women in the Valley have been nominated for board service. Or 2,000 endorsements, representing about 1,200 women, about 2,000 unique endorsements. 50% of the board list is now outside the Valley. And really, we're using it as a marketplace model. So then if you're looking for a board member, you can come to the board list and apply and come check out this highly valuable database of women who've been nominated and find your first board member.
Because second. That's a complaint you hear all the time, is companies say, we love a woman director, but there aren't any. And that's just not true. There's at least 2,000, and all of you should sign up for the board list, too.
Do people sign up, or are they nominated by a venture firm?
Well, the reality is, we think that high-quality supply attracts high-quality demand. So what we're really trying to do is stimulate demand for more board members on private company boards, because we think that leads to better performance, better leadership, better outcomes. And by the way, you guys, if you don't know this already, we're so sick of hearing, all of us, up here about binders full of women. We know they're binders full of women. We have them at the board list too. Quite frankly, that's not the problem. The problem is everybody thinks the only boards that need women on them are public company boards, where the process is very slow and turns over. If you one day want to be on a public company board, go join a nonprofit board, go join a private board. And our job at the board list, I think, is to help bring thought leadership on why a diverse board is so important and how founders need to start thinking about that earlier and earlier in the life cycle of their company.
Claire, I think to answer your question, if I'm getting this right, having nominated some people into the board list, you have both men and women who believe they know qualified people, nominating them into the process. And I knew that Sukhinder was onto something when people in my network started reaching out to me saying, would you endorse me? And I was happy to. And I think it's just building that pipeline, because unfortunately other people have not been building that pipeline.
So, yeah.
And once you're on a board, everybody reaches out to you.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, the amount of solicitation I get to join boards is, and I just don't have, I mean, I'm building a very successful company right now with our founders, but I now can say, look, go to the board list and look at that, because you just get this cycle of once you get in the door, you're okay, and that's just not going
to
build the future
of
diverse boards, right?
And so to answer your question, you can apply, but you do not show up in the results until you're endorsed, because okay. We really actually believe in a peer-to-peer model of endorsement, and that's the way to surface the highest quality of candidate and board, which is our goal.
So I cover venture capital, and there's a joke in that industry, you know, everybody wants to invest or nobody wants to invest. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like once you're on a board, it's really easy to join a second or a third. But if you're on zero boards, how do you get from sort of, okay, I think I could be nominated, I think I'm qualified, to a serious candidate? Because I think one thing that I wouldn't want if I were applying for anything is to feel like my name is being tossed around a lot and it's never actually leading anywhere.
Yeah.
And it's sort of, is that becoming a distraction? Is it not a good thing?
I think that's a great question, and it goes back to what Sukhinder said earlier. You have to essentially be a general manager, or if you're not a general manager, be a domain expert. And so if you're at a startup, generally this is, you're the CEO or the COO. If you're at a bigger company like Google or Salesforce, you could be running a business line, or you could be the head of a certain function or a department. But it's being the best in the world, or one of the best in the world, at something very specific that maps to a need area for that company.
Yeah.
From a career perspective, that's how I would think about it. That's when you know you're ready.
Yeah, and I think coming back to your question about, like, well, you would be frustrated having your name bandied about. Often we hear from people who say, I'm in the board list, but nobody's called me. And I think it comes back to what the panel is saying, which is, look, at the end of the day, boards are largely about specialization, right? There's two typical board profiles. There is, you are a peer to the CEO, and you're coming in to give another operator's perspective on the entire business, in which case it's about general management, right? But then you really need to be actually in a position to be a peer to CEO. So quite frankly, if it's a Series A or B and you're running a Series A or B company, you may be well equipped to be a peer to CEO. If you're a director at a public company, you may be equipped because you're running a business line that's as big as his entire company. So it's just about sort of that matching, right, at the peer-to-peer level. The second model is a CEO who's like a gray hair, whatever that means, but who's already seen the journey you've seen. That's the second flavor of CEO. And the third is very clear. It's a specialist. So if you're wondering if you're not getting the call and why you're not getting the call, go back and look at your resume and, like, understand, at what are you a domain expert? Because that's how you have to market yourself to a board if you're not the CEO of a company.
And I guess that's the easiest way in some ways to get on a board, is to not think about it and start your own company and build a business, and then you actually run a board at least.
Mm-hmm. Start your own company, or at the company you're currently at, be the best at something.
Yes,
yeah. On the leadership team.
Yeah.
Yep.
That makes me wonder, you know, if it's healthy or self-defeating in a way to gun to be on a board, mm-hmm. you know, as your end goal, or if it's really just sort of a reflection of success. And I think part of why we're all here is because historically it has not been the case that just being really successful or a domain expert was enough. But do you guys think we are getting to a point where if some of these talented people really are a domain expert, that they could expect that they will be tapped in the future? Or if not, how far are we?
Well, so I think, first of all, as I said before, I think you've got to grow demand if you want to go supply. I mean, if everybody's thinking about the same Fortune 500 seats, there's only so many, and quite frankly, those boards are turning over faster as older people age out and new people come in with term limits, but it's a very finite supply, right? But I think you have to open up we're in the center of the world where all the action is in small companies. So I think to be on a private board, quite frankly, is nothing to be poo-pooed at. I think it's actually potentially a lot more exciting than being on a public board.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, I think there is something that, you know, this mysterious, you hear people say you should be on a board, you're not sure how to get on a board, you're not sure if it's the end goal. It shouldn't be the end goal, but it is an important part. I think if you're working on your own development and you want to be a leader, a C-level sort of executive somewhere, it is a signal, hey, I am, and I think you get worried that you're not ready, and that's not a worry. You have demonstrated some specialization, you founded a company, you know, you are ready for a lot. But I will say, this reminds me of what happens in companies, sort of with this issue you see on diversity, particularly for women, which is you might have sort of equal numbers of men and women getting hired, and then as the sort of pipeline somehow narrows and women in leadership, the number is like 20%, and why is it not 50%? And I think boards have this problem that we have to address, and there's a two-way street here. One is things like what Sukhinder's doing. The other is, to her point, the private boards need to start thinking about this as something they need, and they should need it earlier. But the other part is, the way I ended up with the particular board that I'm on was an awareness that I should think about it. But honestly, I was at a conference sort of similar to this one, like a thought leadery, a little bit smaller conference. And in that same conference, I met the CEO of Hallmark. We didn't end up even talking about boards. And I met one of the executive search firm board practice leaders, just randomly, like sitting next to each other in the conference, chatted.
It's meant to be.
A year later, I'm in a conversation with them. But I was out there. I mean, it was for work. I was at this event for a good reason. But I was being aware of the network around me. And I think sometimes the wait to get tapped on your shoulder thing doesn't work. You have to be out there, and you need to be meeting people. And that would be my final part of this recommendation, which is, think of, just in the same way, if you think about jobs you might want, companies you might want to join, what do you care about? You know, what matters to you? What products do you use? What are you interested in? And I think technology is a perfect specialization to be in right now. And I mean, look at all of us at pretty young, early points in our career, we got opportunities because I think we took risks in a new industry and started paving new ground. And people are like, uh-oh, I need that industry on my board. So one is, what do you care about? What products and companies are you interested in? How are you in a position to get to know that company better, even if you're happy in your current role, right? This is about a board. The other is, I think where boards really fall down is they don't reflect the user base of the company, right? And that's what I'm actually very proud to be on the Hallmark board. It's predominantly women and moms who are the majority of their viewers for Crown Media. Their Crayola is for kids, right? And the board is actually 50-50, men and women, and actually it's about to tip over to be more women than men. And I think they are really thinking about their user base. And when I think about Stripe, private companies that should be working on this, we have hundreds of thousands of companies building their business with Stripe, from larger companies like a Macy's to Kickstarter to, you've probably used Stripe for Lyft. You know, these are companies. And if you look at, yes, we care about the developers and the entrepreneurs, but we care about the end users of those companies. And they are people who, frankly, are probably using their mobile device to run their lives, right? And so how do you get those people's voice in the boardroom? And you, as a prospect for a board, should be thinking about that. What do I represent? It's almost like government, right? What constituency am I a representative of? I want to be on that board because I represent them. And that could be your technology expertise. It could be you as a user plus your technology expertise. But I think you need to advocate for yourself a bit. And I think sometimes we don't.
That's such a good point. And the constituencies are your customers, your users. They're also the employees and the executives at the company. I mean, how are we going to get focus on placing more women CEOs, more women C-level and executives, if there are no women on the board? Very hard to do, right? Just like the investor problem. There aren't enough women VCs. And so a lot of women-founded startups don't end up getting funded. So I think that's definitely an area. With regard to viewing the board as an end game, I mean, there are plenty of people who do that. But I agree with Claire. It's so powerful to think about as a complement to your personal development. I feel like I'm a better leader and executive, and that I am able to manage my board at Hearsay far better now that I know what it's like on the other side. And I've learned a lot of best practices from Starbucks that's changed how I lead.
One topic we are very passionate about at Salesforce is the topic of equal pay. At Dreamforce 16's Women and Equality Summit, we looked back at the progress women have made and the path ahead towards equal pay. We will hear from people who are defining the rules around equal pay today. With the upcoming release of the film Battle of the Sexes, starring Emma Stone as Billie Jean King, the subject of equal pay is once again rising to the top of our cultural zeitgeist. What will it take for women to finally be paid equal to men? We explore this question and more on our next episode. Don't forget to tune in. Thank you again for joining us on Blazing Trails. Be sure to subscribe, rate, and review us on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. And keep up with exclusive content from amazing trailblazers.